welcome to another episode of South Asia Chat, a podcast brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. Amidst the fight against COVID-19, Pakistan is experiencing some domestic challenges. From the opposition party coming out strongly against the incumbent Imran Khan government to the controversial Gilgit-Baltistan elections. To share insights on these developments, we have with us today Dr. Asim Sajjad Akhtar, an Associate Professor of Political Economy at Quaid-e-Azam University in Pakistan. Dr. Asim is an activist and columnist and has been involved in a lot of progressive political movements. Welcome back to South Asia Chat, Dr. Asim.
Thank you.
Let's begin with the recent developments in Pakistan. The Nawaz Sharif-led party has recently chosen to take on the all-powerful army, criticizing the hybrid model of governance. Now, what, according to you, has prompted Nawaz Sharif to challenge the army? And such efforts to confront the army have failed in the past. Now, what are the prospects this time around?
Yeah, I think, first of all, just to sort of make sure that everybody's clear, it's the formal sort of platform that has, as you say, decided to take on the establishment is called the Pakistan Democratic Movement, which is, at least on the surface, is a 11-party alliance in which Nawaz Sharif's party is one. The Muslim League Nawaz is one of those 11 parties. It's certainly true that the motor force for this PDM does appear to be Nawaz Sharif and his party. Nawaz Sharif, of course, is in London, and it's his daughter Maryam that is sort of taking the hard line and is at the forefront. Nawaz Sharif has, in recent times, in a couple of moots organized by the PDM, recently formed PDM, has delivered speeches online. So what explains Nawaz Sharif, or let's say the PDM in general? Well, basically what has always explained such protests or opposition movements in the past is the fact that often, at least on the surface, the Pakistani politics or the military-dominated polity is viewed by those who are on the outside of the power arrangement at any particular time, such as the PDM parties, to be a zero-sum game. That, you know, it's either you are on the inside of it and you share power, or you're completely excluded. This is also, by the way, is not entirely accurate, because Nawaz Sharif's party is not in government, but you know they have a lot of people in the assemblies. The Pakistan People's Party, which is the other big component of the PDM, is actually running the provincial government of Sindh. So it's more, I think, about the fact that that you know, essentially they want more of a share than they already have. Of course, they don't control the federal government, or the main reins of government are with the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf and the Prime Minister Imran Khan. But the zero-sum game part of the sort of the longer, like I say, the structure of power is generally true. It's quite, the notion that Pakistan's opposition and the government, the elected government, actually, I would say the zero-sum game is vis-a-vis the military and political parties in general. And like all other previous governments, this party in government, the PTI, has sort of acceded to the military's dominant role. And for one reason or the other, and I think that has to do with the fact that Nawaz Sharif has been prime minister three times, he feels equipped and ready and has enough, as he believes, especially in Punjab, which is the dominant province, has enough of a support base to be able to challenge the military. Will it be different this time? Will it actually... will something different be the outcome? It's difficult to say. I'm not convinced that this is a movement that is willing to go deeper than or scratch beneath the surface and think about sort of structural issues that that give the military such a larger than life role. I think it's being talked about openly, certainly, but whether or not the Nawaz Sharif or the PDM parties more generally are willing to undertake long-term sort of structural shifts in the Pakistani state and society, I think, at least for now, is there's no evidence to that effect, and that we will have to wait and see.
Interesting. The 11-party alliance that you've mentioned, they promised to launch protests across the country against the incumbent government. Now, how do you view this joint front? And can the parties realize the rather elusive unity of purpose?
Yeah, and I think that's partly what I was hinting at earlier, is that it's not entirely clear that they all of them share the same interests. As of now, as you started off noting, Nawaz Sharif and his party are, you know, on the surface have the sort of are taking the most hardline stance and being more explicit than ever. The terminology they've used is they've called Imran Khan's government a selected government since it came to power a little over 2 years ago. And so this time Nawaz Sharif has been on record saying, we are less concerned with the selected, and we are, you know, our fight is against the selectors, you know, a barely disguised reference to the military as having propped up the Imran Khan government. The other parties are definitely not as explicit in sort of expressing their positions in this way. And, you know, as soon as this PDM was formed, there were presumably there were some disputes or disagreements about who would become the sort of the leader, as in the president of the alliance. That was eventually a role or a position given to Maulana Fazlur Rahman, who is a cleric associated with the Jamiat Ulema-e Islam, which is a religious organization which has historically actually had quite close ties through the especially to the security establishment, especially with regards to policy in Afghanistan. So the fact that a party like that is also on board, you know, has raised some doubts about the extent to which the PDM is viable and to which they share interests. With Fazlur Rahman, it's the same thing. It's more about being frozen out of a share in the current arrangement rather than necessarily something deeper. I mean, Will, for instance, he has his position on, let's say, women or religious minorities or the role of religion in the polity more generally changed, that there's no real evidence to suggest. So it's a bit of a motley crew, which opposition alliances, of course, tend to be. So that doesn't eliminate the possibility that parties with different backgrounds come together. But as you say, it is, again, another open question, and another question that sort of invites doubt is how similar their interests really are. And again, you know, I wish we could know. We're speculating what will come to pass. So it is a wait and see as far as how, as you say, how much they do express unity of purpose over the next little while.
Meanwhile, the government has announced elections in the disputed Gilgit-Baltistan province on November 15th. Could you share your insights into the significance of these elections? And do you view this as a major shift in Pakistan's Kashmir policy that insisted the region was independent and its future must be decided along with the rest of Kashmir?
Yeah, as you are hinting, there's any number of different sort of fronts that this government has opened up, and the PDM is just one. Just to clarify again, Gilgit-Baltistan is not a province. There's been some talk that it will be announced or some moves will be taken in the coming days to announce it as a province, but it is not yet a province. It is a region that has, since Pakistan came into being, sort of been in constitutional limbo. And it's always been described as just sort of being clumped together with what what Pakistan calls Azad Kashmir. But of course, Gilgit-Baltistanis don't view themselves as simply being subsumed into the Kashmir dispute. Just for clarity's purposes, that so Baltistan borders Ladakh on Pakistan's eastern and India's western sort of sides. So, you know, it is of course very much part of that so larger disputed region. And, you know, whatever they are planning in GB, this government, again, which we can't know because it's always quite opaque, follows the series of events that from August 2019, when the Modi regime revoked Article 370 and changed the constitutional status of Indian Kashmir. And since then, it's been a bit of, you know, back and forth and some, public relations on both sides. The elections, again, are, I think, a part of this. Inevitably, this regime, the Imran Khan regime, or as you said earlier, the hybrid regime, would ideally like to ensure an electoral outcome in GB and Gilgit-Baltistan that facilitates its larger position. Will this whole series of events and this electoral exercise, will it actually signal something substantial in the way Pakistan engages on like the larger question of Kashmir and the region? It's hard to say. I think that critics have said that, you know, since August 2019 and the Modi regime's revocation of Kashmir's constitutional status on the Indian side, that the Pakistani government has not really done much in the face of that, and it's sort of really in some ways sold Kashmir down the river. That's what at least some of the opinion is, or some of the hardline opinion is. If you ask me, I would say that both India and Pakistan historically, this region and its people, whether it's Kashmir on either side or Gilgit-Baltistan on the Pakistani side, continue to be in the crossfires of a geopolitical battle, which doesn't really do much for either side, either side's people, their rights, their resources. So I don't see that changing. Whether that means the Pakistani government's position becomes more or less stringent vis-a-vis India, I don't know. But ultimately, there has to be, it's only a long-term peace that can be beneficial for the people of the region. And that, with these regimes in power, with Modi on the one hand, and this, as you rightfully point out, hybrid regime or military-dominated regime on the other, I can't foresee substantial sort of peace moves on either side taking place. And so that would mean really more of the same, no matter what the surface phenomena appear to be.
Now, moving into the geopolitics of the issue, it has been reported that Pakistan is under pressure from China to remove the legal ambiguity surrounding the status of the GB region. What are China's interests on this issue, and how are they related to the CPEC?
Yeah, I mean, that's basically what the interests are. CPEC, of course, now, has gotten enough publicity that everybody knows, the world knows, the region knows that this is China's flagship One Belt, One Road project in this part, and signals further cementing of Pakistan-China relations, and it's through the GB region. So it's GB, if you go all the way up to the top, to the northern tip of the Gilgit-Baltistan region, that you hit the Khunjarab Pass, which is where the Pakistan-China border is. And it's through there that, for instance, part of CPEC is a fiber optic that is going to be the heartbeat of Pakistan's entire digital network apparatus, including surveillance, mind you. It's through that border zone that that most of the transportation network already existed, but with under CPEC, you know, with greater trade and economic links and ties. So needless to say, this region is significant to China, let alone to Pakistan, as part of its larger geoeconomic strategy, let's call it. So it's, you know, it's like everything else, I'd say, in Pakistan, you know, it's whether it's China or historically America. Pakistan's foreign patrons have always played an important and larger than life role in what are nominally autonomous domestic policy decisions. Again, it's hard to know the extent to which there's any arm twisting involved on the part of China to get the GB issue sorted. And when I say sorted, it means, as I said, not necessarily in the interests of its people, but in a way that can meet China's needs for stability. Mind you, something similar has been talked about and has been sort of, you know, more or less apparent in Balochistan, which is, of course, the bottom southern end of the CPEC project, which is Gwadar Port, which is a province not dissimilar to GB in terms of its political instability, but actually in some ways more, because there's been an insurgency, a low-level insurgency in Balochistan for many years. So, you know, over the years there too, it's been talked about, well, you know, China needs security for its investments. So inevitably, I think there's obviously a kernel of truth to that. Whether this question of, or these rumors about GB being made a province, in recent times is directly due to China's influence, again, is something that we can't be certain of, but it totally adds up that China does want an arrangement that is a sort of allows for long-term stability and makes sure that it's, you know, $60-70 billion investment via CPEC is secure.
You did touch upon India with regards to the GB region in one of your comments earlier, but we would still like to know if, on a wildly optimistic note, Pakistan's move offered a basis for Kashmir settlement by recognizing the territorial status quo.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there, as I said, there have been voices in Pakistan that have said that, look, the bravado notwithstanding, in effect, since August 2019, Pakistan's effective policy has suggested that they're sort of quietly, you know, acceding to the line of control as being a sort of a permanent border. Again, I'm not certain of that. It's hard to say. I think that there, you know, the domestic compulsions in Pakistan, not because, you know, 220 million Pakistanis are wildly, you know, buying into the hype as they always have for 70 years or anything, that, you know, Kashmir banega Pakistan, so to speak, but because, you know, it's sort of there is this perception in the political mainstream that anybody who is not firm enough on Kashmir and doesn't maintain the historic policy, which is that we don't buy the line of control and that we, you know, we demand a plebiscite, UN resolutions, and so on and so forth, and third-party intervention. So I'm not certain that we can just slip from that public historic position to, yes, okay, we'll just accept things as they are finally. It may come to pass, but I think there'll be more, you know, bumps along the way yet. My feeling is, and that has as much to do with, you know, playing to the gallery, which I think happened with Modi prior to the elections with Balmama, and, you know, there is always more than meets the eye in terms of, you know, the perceptions of any individual government upholding nationalist sort of fervor. And, you know, as far as optimism is concerned, I'd be optimistic if I felt that any of these moves, whether it's to slowly move towards an institutionalization of the line of control as a permanent border, or GB becoming a province, or anything happening on the Indian side, if I felt that it actually included the people of the regions. But that's not happening on either side. You know, these are state-level initiatives that are not necessarily suggesting a deepening of any kind of democratic aspirations of the people. And that, I think, for me, if you read between the lines, is the ultimately the most important thing. And that if that were to happen, or if there were moves in those directions on either side, then I would potentially be cautiously optimistic.
If we have to discuss the other important power in the country, which is the United States, Trump has announced the withdrawal of the U.S. troops in Afghanistan by this Christmas. Now, what do you think would be the implications for Pakistan?
Yeah, the implications are enormous. You know, yet another border region, or a neighboring sort of region or country that has always been you know, has a significant impact, has been one of the big reasons why the military has remained powerful in Pakistan, and B, had a huge spillover effect into Pakistan itself, most notably with the 1980s and the so-called jihad. And I think that, you know, for 20 years since the most recent conflict in Afghanistan, when the U.S. invaded and occupied and Pakistan has facilitated that, there's been a lot of wrangling behind the scenes about Pakistan's role in Afghanistan. And Pakistan has historically, at least since the 1980s, always wanted, in fact, prior to that even, wanted a larger-than-life role, wanted a, so to speak, pro-Islamabad government in Kabul. I don't think that that has changed. And I think that now that the Americans are formally sort of, or are effectively reducing their role in Afghanistan, that inevitably means that Pakistan's role is going to be in the spotlight. And as far as Pakistan's strategic planners are concerned, Pakistan's role is going to increase. And I think that these are, you know, what will happen there will have a big impact domestically as well, because, you know, for instance, on the particular border zone with Afghanistan, there has been a anti-war movement in the last 2.5 years that has played that has been a very big factor in Pakistan's sort of come to light in Pakistan's mainstream about local people, Pashtuns, called the Pashtun Tahaffuz Movement, who want peace, who are calling attention to the reemergence of Taliban sort of militants, and of course, if there's something like a somewhat institutionalized Taliban government in Kabul, or at least with a big share of the Taliban in government, that will spill over into Pakistan. And so, you know, again, here it's a question of what are the visions of our strategic planners in conflict with the visions of the people of the region? And I suspect, I feel like probably that is going to happen, that there is going to be, you know, a resurgence to an extent of the Taliban within Pakistan as well, assuming that there is a share of power given to the Taliban in Kabul. And that makes perfect sense. Because they are, after all, ideological brethren, one way or the other, and that is, I think, a concern for any voice of peace in Pakistan. But you know, that reflects, frankly, the diabolical 20 years later, after 2001, when the Americans came into Afghanistan. It just reflects what a diabolical initiative that was. That 20 years later, you're essentially you know, handing back at least some power to the very same forces that you had claimed to eliminate. And I think these are the stories all over South Asia, Kashmir, Afghanistan, you know, within Pakistan and India and their ethnic peripheries, that you have these long-standing political conflicts that are exacerbated by military means, and therefore they keep rearing their head again and again.
And finally, Dr. Asim, how do you see the forthcoming U.S. election impacting U.S. and Pakistan relations?
I think that certainly the election will have, will have an impact, not just in Pakistan, but around the world, given, 4 years of Trump have really, served as a strange contradictory, both retreating into self, but yet also engaging erratically. And I think Pakistan and South Asia are an example of that. So I think more than anything else, if a Biden administration was to come into existence, it would be more consistent in its engagements with Pakistan and the region. I think that there are still two fundamental issues that the U.S. state, and I'm not talking about any particular government, the U.S. Is interested in and will engage with Pakistan on and will articulate clearly its policy or its positions on. The first, of course, is China, and there will still be an interest in Washington to ensure that the American sort of historic American sort of patronage or role as the primary patron of the Pakistani state is not at least totally displaced, and they will keep a watchful eye. I'm not sure. I think it'll be different than. With the Trump administration, which of course has clearly just eyeballed China regularly, I think a Biden administration would be more circumspect. But it's certainly true that the Americans would be concerned if they were to be displaced from their role of influence in Pakistan by the Chinese. And so they'll keep an eye on it, and they'll make sure that they express their desire to continue, whether it's being especially military aid. Historically, the relationship between the Pentagon and Pakistan's army has been sort of, I think, the most significant part of the U.S.-Pakistan relationship. I think that'll continue because of Afghanistan in particular, and I think the Americans will be keen to exert influence accordingly via which, as we've talked about throughout this podcast, is still Pakistan's most powerful political player, which is the army. And then there's the Kashmir question or, the larger question of the disputed region. And I suspect, my feeling is that, again, that you asked about China and what its interest is in GB or in the region at large. I think the Americans, too, will push Pakistan to, as you noted, to perhaps come up with something resembling a permanent settlement. All of these things are interrelated. The question of militancy in the region, the question of Kashmir, the question of Afghanistan. I think that broadly speaking, the Americans are not going to have the same footprint in the region militarily that they've had until recent years. And that, I think, essentially means that Pakistan will be a major player in terms of articulating American influence. What Pakistan's intentions are and how it plays off the U.S. and China, will of course be important too. But as I said, for me, the biggest difference if a new administration would come into power would be something considerably more sustained engagement with Pakistan rather than the sort of more erratic, engagements that we've seen under Trump.
Thank you so much, Dr. Asim, for taking time and joining us back on South Asia Chat. And as always, thank you for the wonderful insights.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. Thank you very much.
If you wish to know more about our work, please visit www.isas.nus.edu.sg. Thank you so much for tuning in.